Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When was the United States really born? While the Revolution, the American Revolution, wrested control of our lives and tax money from the British Empire, the Articles of Confederation that transformed the colonies into 13 sovereign states were already failing just a decade after their adoption. So in the steamy summer of 1787, 55 delegates gathered in secret in Philadelphia, then the nation's capital, to create a stronger framework. Their impassioned arguments, fueled by both brilliant inspiration and the occasional peculiar suggestion, allowed them to hammer out within 4 months a document that defines the United States system of government even today. David O. Stewart's book, The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution, tells the story of that amazing process, including the roles of the men who were instrumental among the framers but have largely been erased from public memory. David O. Stewart is my guest for this hour. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Reading the book, we really come away with this sense that this is a country founded as much on compromise as on any particular moral principle. Can you talk about that?
Well, there were very serious disagreements among the delegates who came to the convention and between North and South and small states and big states, and they ultimately were able to agree on the Constitution only by each group really ending up sacrificing things they cared a great deal about. And I truly believe, although the Constitution itself has proved to be a durable and excellent document, one of the most important contributions they made, maybe the most important, was to establish a political culture or perpetuate a political culture where you expect compromise, where nobody expects to win everything. And I think that's how people live together.
Is that culture part of American government today, do you think?
You know, I do think it is. I think, you know, we careen a bit from side to side as the decades go on. And, you know, I think there are always individuals who don't want to do that. But, you know, a politician who's in the game long enough learns that that's what he has to do. Even President Bush, who was not a big compromiser, if he's confronted with, you know, a situation where he's going to lose, he'll try to make the best deal he can.
So let's go back a couple hundred years. With the Articles of Confederation, they had been around for about a decade. In essence, you already had sort of Americans fighting Americans under this document.
Well, it really was an important crystallizing moment. I think you're referring to is Shays' Rebellion, which happened just a few months before the delegates met in Philadelphia. And it's an event we all sort of recognize the name of. We were told it in grammar school, but we don't remember much about it. And it really was tragic. There were farmers and mechanics, tradesmen in New England who were unable to pay their taxes, were losing their houses, were losing their farm animals. They were all being taken for non-payment of taxes. And they rose up. First, they tried to close the courts, and they succeeded in that. And they ended up, 3,000 of them, marching on the federal arsenal in Springfield, Massachusetts, where they faced off against state troops. And it seems they really didn't expect to be opposed. They were, after all, Americans. But Americans fired on Americans. Only four were killed. Many were wounded. It was a very short battle. The rebels ran away. But it was a terrible moment for the leaders. Washington writes agonized letters after that. Just 3.5 years after we've beaten the British and won this victory for the ages, we're unable to maintain peace amongst ourselves. It really was a measure of the failure.
Yeah, and at this point, before we had the Constitution, you had each individual state sort of conducting its own foreign policy. Several of them had their own navies. Whatever sort of federal system existed wasn't able to officially collect taxes from any of the states.
Yes, the tax issue was central, tax and currency. And at some level, it sounds pretty good. Government can't impose taxes, but if you want to have an army or a navy, it's a real problem. When Shays' rebels were marching, Congress adopted a resolution saying, you know, calling out the troops, but they had no money to pay them. So actually Massachusetts had to field its own troops. So it was a huge issue, and they just had to beg the national government under the Articles of Confederation had to beg the states for money. The currency issue was also huge. There was no national currency, and between the two of them, every economic transaction became a currency negotiation, and nobody had enough currency to pay their taxes. That was one of the big problems the farmers had. There was so little currency in circulation. What there was British pound sterling, which was kind of embarrassing. I mean, we'd beaten the British, and here we're still using their money. So the economic failures were tremendous as well.
You know, it's tempting to look back and think, well, it's too bad they couldn't have come up with a system like the Constitution back, you know, a decade earlier. But I get the sense that we almost had to live with the Articles of Confederation for that long in order to evolve sort of politically and culturally to understand what we actually required in a permanent constitution.
Very much. That's an important insight. That Americans had seen a strong central government and the British Empire, and they didn't like it. So when they set up the Articles of Confederation, they left the states very independent. One leader described the Congress then as a diplomatic body. It wasn't really a single nation, almost. And I think we did have to see the failures of having such a decentralized system and confront them. Because, frankly, even when the Constitution was proposed, there were quite a few people who thought it created too strong a central government.
Some who wanted three or four different countries.
There was open talk in Congress in the 1780s before the convention of having three nations, and New England and the Middle States and the South would just go their own way, and maybe even a fourth nation on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains. So everything was on the table. You know, it was a brand new country. Nobody quite knew how it was going to end.
Yeah, I think the other thing that really comes across reading the book is, you know, now it's been our history for so long that we sort of imagine that it couldn't have gone any other way. But there were a lot of variables to be discussed at the time, how much power the president would have. And a huge issue was deciding how Congress would be set up and how representation would happen from each state.
Well, that's right. There was an expectation that the basic three-part government structure that we know with the president and Congress and courts is what would be produced. That's what the state governments had. So that was not a huge innovation. But as you say, how you pick the Congress, until the Constitution, each state had a single vote in Congress. So Delaware, which was tiny then and still is, and Pennsylvania, which was giant then and is not quite as giant anymore, had the same vote, which made the people from Pennsylvania crazy. And you know, they didn't quite know what to do with the president. They were very concerned that they not create a new king. They didn't like kings. But they were pretty sure they needed somebody to sort of make things happen. So these were very difficult balances to strike.
David O. Stewart is my guest. His book is called The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution. James Madison is often called the father of the Constitution, and I think many people have in the back of their minds the sense that he was the one who sort of contributed most of the ideas. Would you talk about his actual role in the process?
Well, he was very important. I do tend to take a contrarian view and take issue with the notion that he was the father of the Constitution. He helped very much, was essential to getting the convention called, and participated with the other Virginians in presenting the first proposal, the Virginia Plan, which is what the delegates basically played off of for the first 6 or 8 weeks of the convention. And he took all the notes during the of the debates. Without his note-taking, I couldn't have written the book. And he was an active participant. He engaged on the major issues. He was widely respected. He was a very smart, studious guy. People listened to him. But I don't feel and haven't felt when I've gone through the materials, you know, the debates, the motions we have, the amendments, and frankly, the records of the committees, that he was the father in the way that people think of him. Really, most of the tough issues were decided in committee meetings, not in the full convention. And he wasn't on any committees to the last 2 weeks of the convention. That was very telling to me. And I also found when he spoke, and he spoke well, you would expect him to give pretty good versions of his own speeches and his own notes, people tended not to change their minds, or not even to play off him. They would just sort of go on as the debate had been before. And other speakers seemed to have more impact on the direction of the debate. So as I studied it, I really came to the conclusion that although a very important delegate, it's not really right to call him the father of the Constitution.
What sort of experience and expertise did most of the delegates bring to the convention?
Well, there were a lot of lawyers there.
As always.
Yeah, you know, we tend to flock to these opportunities. And, you know, lawyers have some skills that are useful in these things. Something in the neighborhood of half of them had legal training. They were all wealthy. And you could not afford to be away from home doing this important public service not paid unless you were a pretty rich guy. There were a number of landowners. There were probably, maybe a quarter of them were slave owners, which is an important issue that bollocksed up the convention a good bit and had been sort of a surprise to me. They were young. I think we tend to be struck by how young they were. There were some older delegates. Ben Franklin was 81. There were several in their 60s. But the predominant cohort was in their 30s and early 40s. It was a young country. These were young people.
And most of them had experience having formed, or at least their states had recently formed state constitutions. So they had that sort of in the backs of their minds. How similar was one state's constitution to the next?
Well, they were very well informed about their state constitutions. As you say, they had many of them had participated them, or at least served in the state government. They did follow this sort of tripartite structure of government. The separation of powers is how we refer to it now. And they would cherry pick what they liked in one state government and as opposed to another. Maryland had a state senate situation, where the Senate was designed to be smaller, more aristocratic, more thoughtful, and the lower house was designed to be closer to the people. They liked that, and they copied that. South Carolina had an arrangement where only money bills could only be presented in the lower house, and that was copied, although it was controversial. Even the South Carolinians claimed they didn't like it very much. But they looked around, and they would, you know, borrow from models that they found persuasive.
And there was, even early then, a huge amount of discussion over the issue of slavery. We think of this as something that came up so much later.
Yeah, that was a big surprise for me, and was one of my motives in writing the book, really, was when I had occasion in my own law practice to read Madison's notes, I was quite struck by how often and violently they clashed over slavery. And I hadn't known that, and I, you know, was a person of mature years. I thought I really should have. And so I wanted to tell that story. They didn't mean to deal with slavery. 12 states allowed slavery at the time. Only Massachusetts made it illegal. That's not why they met in Philadelphia. It wasn't an anti-slavery convention. But when they were trying to figure out how to set up the country, they kept running into the fact that something like 1 in 6 people in the country were slaves. It was 600,000 out of 3.9 million.
David O. Stewart is my guest. His book is called The Summer of 1787. We'll be back right after this break. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David O. Stewart. His book is called The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution. If you'd like to join the conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. Before the break, David, you were talking about how slavery really was part of the discussion, not only, I guess, as a moral issue at that point, but also as an issue of representation and population.
Absolutely. It was really just a question of power politics. It became central when people like James Madison and James Wilson of Pennsylvania insisted that there must be representative democracy. There should be representation based on population. And the Southerners immediately became quite anxious because such a large part of their population was enslaved. That meant that if those people didn't vote and weren't citizens, which they weren't going to be, they would be excluded and the Southerners would have a lot less power. That became a huge fight. And it became sort of a three-way fight because the small states wanted to continue having one state, one vote. The big states wanted proportional representation, and the Southerners had this odd notion of quotas of contribution, which is tough to get your brain around, frankly, but seems to mean wealth, and they were going to count their slaves in their wealth and thereby have their slaves represented. And this ultimately was resolved in quite a grimy compromise where it was established that the slaves would count for three-fifths of a person when you were allocating seats for Congress and ultimately electoral votes for president. And Madison tried to justify this in the Federalist Papers he wrote after the convention, and he described it candidly as, well, it treats the slaves as though they are part property and part human, and after all, isn't that what they are? It's really a sort of creepy thing to read, certainly from someone we're led to think as a great leader, but it was, in fact, accurate, and it was a compromise that got them through a very tough place.
Meanwhile, you have the first real sort of public abolitionist communications coming from this delegate from Pennsylvania, Governor Morris. And that's a name rather than a title.
Yes. Well, I've been instructed it should be pronounced Gouverneur.
Oh, Gouverneur. Okay.
It's a Dutch name. He was a wonderful character, a tall, good-looking fellow. He'd lost the bottom of a leg in a carriage accident. He was a ladies' man, and all of his friends wanted him to have lost a leg while in flight from a jealous husband, which was not the official story, but his friends were eager for that to be true. But Morris was, although he was a Pennsylvania delegate, he was actually from New York. The Pennsylvanians had a very open mind about who they would send. And he spoke more often at the convention than anyone else. He actually wasn't there for 3 weeks, so you know that when he was there, he was really talking. And he got very angry about two-thirds of the way through the convention with how much the South was getting. The Southern politicians, particularly this fellow Rutledge from South Carolina, were very effective and had a draft that was very much to their liking. And Morris really stood up and sort of swept the curtain aside and pointed out what was behind all of this. And he chose to denounce slavery, which no one else had at the time. And he called it a curse of heaven that will curse this nation forever. And he really changed the debate that some less friendly provisions to slavery were adopted after his speech. And I think it's a wonderful speech. I still sort of thrilled to read it. It was a terrific moment. And there were other delegates there who were anti-slavery, but there were people who had, a couple delegates had actually freed their own slaves. Others belonged to anti-slavery societies. But it was not a broad national movement the way it became in the 19th century. And the focus really of a lot of it was on the slave trade, which was really quite vicious.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is David O. Stewart. His book is called The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution. It has just been re-released in tradeback. Let's speak to Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if the author was familiar with Murray Rothbard's critique of the Constitution, and that it essentially adopts all the powers of the monarchy model as far as property rights and these sorts of things. He's a libertarian, so he sees a little conflict between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If we vest these powers not in a monarch who's sort of there forever, but into whatever order can convince us, and it ends up in a really awful system. You know, now we are 200 years later.
Thomas, unfortunately we have a bad connection, but I do think we had the question about the oligarchy, so we'll get an answer for you. Thank you so much for your call.
I'm not totally familiar with Mr. Rothbard, but it's certainly true that the Constitution is a very different document from the Declaration of Independence, which is really not about setting up a government. It's not a practical document. It's an advocacy piece, essentially. And the Constitution is generally thought to be a more conservative document in many ways. It's not proclaiming war. It's not proclaiming rights. In fact, they left the Bill of Rights out, which we'll probably talk about. But it did figure out how to set up a government, and part of the government was protecting property rights, and that's what the men in the room wanted to do. They had property.
The Bill of Rights that you mentioned was sort of proposed initially by, was it George Mason?
George Mason and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
And they did not sign, ultimately.
Yeah. They had each had a number of reasons for not signing in addition to the Bill of Rights. In fact, I think their fellow delegates thought the Bill of Rights was sort of a pretext for them not signing. Mason was very upset they were upset about issues that maybe don't motivate us a lot today, but Mason was very upset that there was not a two-thirds vote requirement for commercial laws. Elbridge Gerry was very upset that it would allow a standing army. He thought a standing army meant that we would ultimately be have a despotism in the country. So those were other problems they had, but they also did criticize it for failing to have protecting any rights. The Constitution does protect right of jury trial in a criminal case and right of habeas corpus, which just came up in the Guantanamo cases, but it does not protect very many rights at all. And that's why we did end up having to have the Bill of Rights.
Seems the perfect time to note that everyone of the framers who was there imagined that there would be amendments and changes and things to come. No one thought that they were walking away in 1787 from a document that would not change.
Absolutely right. And the one statement at the convention that I quote twice is by George Mason, where he says it's very important that we create an amendment process that, although difficult, is doable, because what we do will definitely be defective. And it was. I mean, they got some things wrong. They left out the Bill of Rights. They screwed up how you elect the president. I mean, there were some immediate fixes that needed to be made, and that were in the first 15 years.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jack in Dallas. Hi, Jack. Hello, Jack.
Hi, I'm calling wondering what the author's thoughts are on when I'm in debates with friends, sometimes they'll say the Christian values of all of our founding fathers as why American law should be based on many Christian ideals. I'm wondering what the author's thoughts are on how many of the founding fathers were practicing Christians and how many of their conversations were based on Christian values.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a great question. Most of the delegates were members of one denomination or another, almost all Protestant, although there were a couple of Catholics there. The more important question to me, it seems, is the second part of his question, which is, you know, how did they talk about it, how did it influence the document, because there's virtually no evidence that Christian concerns animated them at all.
Was that a factor of the sort of post-Enlightenment culture that you had?
Yes. There was a feeling, frankly, that religion was the province of each individual person. It was ultimately embodied in the First Amendment very quickly after the Constitution was ratified. They did include the one provision in the Constitution that relates to religion says that there will be no religious test of any federal office holder. So that was simply to deny religion's importance to whether you could serve the nation. And otherwise, they didn't talk about it. There was one odd episode when they were really at each other's throats when Ben Franklin suggests maybe we should bring in a minister to say a benediction every morning, and thinking about being greater than ourselves, we will come to agreement more easily, which was an interesting thing for him to say because he was not a churchy guy himself. And Alexander Hamilton jumped up and said, well, that'd be a terrible idea. If we do that, everybody will know we're trying to kill each other in here, and that's bad. And then a third guy got up and said, well, we don't have any money to pay a minister, so we can't do it anyway. And they didn't. So you really don't find any evidence that it was important. Now, you know, some of them doubtless were religious people and for whom their religions were important. But they didn't see this occasion as an occasion for them to be inserting their religion into the way we would run our government.
How personally, David, did they take the kind of arguments that they got into during this convention? It sounds like sometimes they were going at it tooth and nail. Were they able to sort of have an ale at the end of the day, or did they leave with resentments toward each other in a personal way?
I think many of them were able to disagree and then get along. If you look at the people who came into Washington's administration afterwards, he took in people who had opposed him as well as people who hadn't. Even folks who didn't sign, like Edmund Randolph, ended up in Washington's cabinet. He did ultimately turn himself around and say he did support the Constitution. Elbridge Gerry became vice president under James Madison. But there were a few enmities that, frankly, didn't go away. Washington got extremely angry with George Mason, and Mason opposed the Constitution in the ratification debates in Virginia. And it appears they really never spoke again, and they'd been friends for decades, 40 years anyway. There were a few others, more obscure people. It seems, frankly, that they just decided they would hate each other after that. But by and large, the major players, they realized they gave each other credit for trying to, fight the tough fight and then move on. One of the toughest delegates there was John Rutledge of South Carolina, and he won a lot of fights there. But when he finally got skunked on some things, the Southerners threatened to walk out, and he stood up and lectured the Southerners and said, look, we're building an empire here. This is a big thing, and we're not going to walk out just because we lost this round. And there was real leadership in that room of people who were willing to fight hard, but they knew at the end of the day they wanted to have a new nation.
David O. Stewart is my guest. The book is called The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution. Let's speak next to Jimmy in Dallas. Hi, Jimmy.
Hello. Yes, I have a question, please. This has to do with the Native Americans who are already, of course, and was there any part of the Constitution modeled after their rules? I've always heard they were, but that might be hearsay. And then what did they do with the Native American issues? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I'm delighted to get that question. I've been talking about this book for a year now, and nobody's ever asked it. The Native American issue did not really come up. Clearly, it was discussed in side conversations because the Native Americans were not counted for things like allocating congressmen and are expressly excluded and for tax issues. So they were recognized essentially as citizens of other nations. But it wasn't really a subject of discussion. Oh, Lord, and I've slipped on the other part of that question.
I guess the question was essentially, if they had been mentioned, how were they handled? And I suppose the question was they weren't handled at all.
Or were given the
opportunity to participate in this sort of process of democracy. Oh, and the other question was whether or not any of the Constitution was based on Native American law.
Yes, and that I wanted to respond to that. There is a tradition, it's sort of an urban legend, that it was based on the Iroquois Confederacy. And there's even, I found at least one book that claimed John Rutledge as a young man had gone to upstate New York and sat with the Iroquois and learned their wisdom. There is no credible basis for this. And, you know, maybe it operated in somebody's mind somewhere, but there's no written evidence of it.
So there were six Iroquois nations that were confederated, but they didn't have any kind of laws similar to what we found in the Constitution later.
Well, there's no indication that anybody was drawing on their laws. That the similarities are in no way striking. Mm-hmm. They did have their own system. I don't mean to denigrate it at all, but it was not something that you can track to what was produced in Philadelphia.
Yeah, what's so interesting about this is we look at the Constitution today, and it has clearly more strengths than weaknesses. But no matter what, even in this brand new nation, nothing is being created in a vacuum. Everybody came to this with biases and ideas about the way things ought to be based on what they had known before, not only in what was the United States, but back in Europe.
Well, sure. And six of the delegates were actually immigrants, which was you know, an important thing for us to keep in mind. And they argued over provisions we're familiar with. You know, the president has to be a native-born American. This is an issue now with Senator McCain. There's people who claim since he was born in the Canal Zone, he's not native-born. Congressmen and senators have to live in this country for a certain period of time before they can run, and they argued over that. And they were united, though, generally, in the view that monarchy, really the dominant form in Europe for 1,000 years, was not the way to go.
David O. Stewart is my guest. We'll take more of your calls about his book, The Summer of 1787, after this quick break. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author David O. Stewart. His book is called The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we find Mel in Dallas. Hi, Mel.
Hey, how you doing? Chris, I love your show.
Thank you.
And I'd like to just pose this question. I hope I don't bring the room down, because there will always seem to be a celebration of the courage and the fortitude of the founding fathers, but there's a part about the Constitution that always has bothered me. I'm an American. I'm a veteran. I've been in the military and everything. But I always hear about the grace of the founding fathers, of George Washington. But George Washington owned 200 slaves, plus 200 slaves, and a lot of founding fathers. And I just can't see how can you rationalize saying you're a free nation and we all have the pursuit of liberty and we'll fight and die for it. But at the same time, during the same period, there are all these men, the majority of who had any wealth, were owning slaves. At the same time, they're saying freedom to all men, but they were actually having people in suffrage like that. It seems like a contradiction, a very large contradiction. I'd like to know what the author's opinion is of the men who were so-called freedom-loving founding fathers owning slaves at the time when they were saying all men should be born free.
Hey, thanks for your call, Mel.
Well, Mel, you're right. There was a huge dose of hypocrisy in the whole enterprise. What was fascinating to me was to learn just how much the framers themselves, really the Virginians in particular, understood their own hypocrisy. Somehow we managed to disconnect them from really, I would call it the sin of owning slaves. They did most of the time, but not always. So men like Madison, men like Washington, Edmund Randolph, George Mason, acknowledged that there was basically no justification for owning another human being. It was simply an economic convenience for them. And I have to agree with you, it speaks ill of them that they were unable to disconnect themselves from it. There were abolitionist-minded people at the convention. Ben Franklin was the head of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. Alexander Hamilton and William Livingston of New Jersey were active in the New York Society. But abolition then didn't mean what it came to mean, sort of breaking off the shackles and setting people free. It really meant a gradual abolition, which is ultimately what was adopted in many states. This is a tremendous contradiction. Edmund Burke, a famous English politician, liked to sneer that in America, those who own the most slaves are the ones who preach most about liberty. And there was a certain truth to it. And it is something that it took us many, many years to fix and many, many lives. And it is a compelling part of the story that in the Constitutional Convention, they actually came face-to-face with it a few times, and it was a huge battle, and they were not willing to take on the issue directly. The slave states came into the Union as slave states. They'd owned slaves before the country existed, so they just tried to ameliorate it to some extent. They did it with the Three-Fifths Clause. They also did allow the abolition of the slave trade after 20 years, which happened. These were not solutions. These were, you know, picking at the edges of it. But that's the best they felt they could do. The Southerners were quite adamant on the political issue that if anybody attacked slavery, they would not be part of the nation.
The fact that women really don't figure into the Constitution at all, is that a factor of the reality that they just weren't part of political and public life at that time?
I have to say so, yes. It is embarrassing, and women often ask me this with sort of a unhappy look on their faces. There were, of course, no women delegates. We don't even have Abigail Adams to write smart letters about it because her husband John was in London as British minister at the time. There were a few women in Philadelphia who were prominent hostesses, and people went to their homes. I'm sure there were intelligent women there, and they probably said things that were useful and important. But I think, you know, you have to remember, and you mentioned it in the opening part of the program, that this was a secret convention. The delegates did not talk about what they were doing when they got outside the convention.
Why was it a secret?
They thought, and I think they were right, they would be more candid if they didn't have to worry about everybody knowing about the stupid things they said. I mean, they said some stupid things in the convention. It's sort of liberating to hear James Madison give a speech where he says one house of Congress should be dedicated to protecting the slave interest and the other house should be dedicated to not protecting the slave interest. It's a ridiculous way to set up a government. He actually gave that speech twice. And it helps us feel like, well, you know, the guy did not bat 1,000. They thought that was important, that they be free to really air all of their thoughts. When they were trying to figure out how to pick the president, there were crazy ideas that were proposed. But it gave them the freedom to do that. And I do think that was a good thing. And I question whether you could do it today. I think we would lose a lot because you can't. But it was important to them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to David in Wiley. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And for the great show. I'm really looking forward to this book. A quick comment on the last point. It's almost always a mistake to judge the culture and morality of the past through the lens of those of the present. My question is, and I'll listen off the air, you know, the United States of America is no more immortal than was Ur of the Chaldees or the Byzantine Empire. Representative democracy is frankly, and in bad shape these days if you look at the reality of it. And I'm wondering if your guest would like to prognosticate on the future, because he has such a good perspective of the past and how American government might evolve over the next century. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, those are interesting ideas and a tough question. You know, it's important to remember that the delegates were, I think, would be stunned that the Constitution has lasted this long. Some said at the time they'd be delighted if it lasted 50 years. The Articles of Confederation lasted for six. In terms of the future, so much is tied up with so much else, but if you're just looking at the constitutional structure, I think our biggest challenge is what do we do with the president? The presidency was thought to be the weakest, the weaker of the two parts of government compared to Congress. That's what the framers thought. They didn't put a lot of protections against the president getting too powerful. Part of that was because they didn't really get to the presidency till the end of the convention. They were tired and hot, and Madison admitted afterwards they sort of hadn't been as careful about it as they had been about Congress. But they never anticipated the growth in the executive branch, the growth in government, the way the world has changed. I mean, it's changed tremendously. It used to take 2 days to get from Philadelphia to New York. Well, now it takes 80 minutes. The Internet. I mean, there are lots of things, ways of controlling people that they never imagined. And I think for the 21st century, what we do with the presidency, how we control it, how we prevent it from controlling us, is a really important thing, because it seems to me that when we now have the president face off against Congress, the president is holding the face cards and, frankly, gets to do things that the framers would be very surprised about. And I think that's something we need to think hard about if that's really the way we want to live.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. I've always been fascinated by the ability of how erudite these people were, their ability to think critically and to write clearly and to speak. I mean, it's just amazing. So I've wondered what, if your research took you into any information about what kind of an education system did these people go through as young people?
I guess it must have varied, right?
It was varied, and there were some formal ways to be educated. Many, you know, if you lived on a plantation, you would be educated by a tutor, if you were wealthy and as opposed to a slave. And there were some early colleges. The South Carolina delegates had all been educated in Britain. They went over and read law at the Inns of Court. They were quite wealthy people. The way I sometimes think about them, though, is they had a lot fewer books than we do, but they read them a lot more carefully, and they thought about them harder. And it does show up. They really have mastered what they've studied. You know, not all of them. There were some guys there, and I don't mean to be flip, but there were some folks there who were not smarter than the average bear. But the leaders, the people who really made the thing go, included people like Rutledge and James Wilson and James Madison and George Mason, who were extremely smart and had studied hard. And it shows. But it was very much a small-scale form of study in small groups or even just on their own.
Why are people like Rutledge and like George Mason and like Gouverneur Morris not household words in the same way that some of the other delegates were?
Well, it varies. It hurts if you back the wrong side, which Mason did. He opposed the Constitution. And, you know, that just meant he was, his name was mud for a generation or two. Gouverneur Morris was sort of a conservative guy, very aristocratic, and quickly the nation's politics got away from him, and he was no longer particularly relevant after the first few years of the new nation, and he got forgotten. There are a couple who just died in miserable ways, or their Rutledge in particular ended up really, frankly, having mental illness and misbehaved in public a few times, and then tried to kill himself. He became an embarrassment to people of his generation. He'd been a brilliant man, but he had, it seems he was in a depression and couldn't get out of it. James Wilson, almost worse. He ended up, he became prone to this need for wealth that led him to speculative investments, huge debts, and he ended up with his life. He was a justice of the Supreme Court, and he was on the lam from the law. There were warrants for his arrest in four states for his debts. And he ultimately died of malaria in North Carolina while being confined to the Hornblower Tavern because his creditor would not let him leave. So, you know, Wilson's reputation was destroyed. Nobody who knew him could do anything except shake his head over him. And that meant that for 50 years, nobody wrote about him. And that just perpetuated itself. So there are some sort of sad stories that come out of the convention.
David, you talked earlier about the fact that the founding fathers might be very surprised by the amount of power that the president has today. What would their assessment be, do you think, of the balance of power between states' rights and federalism?
Well, on that one, it might depend on the delegate you were talking to. I think that was the one creative thing they did, was to create a federal form with balanced powers between state and federal. And, you know, we've changed those that balance over the years. In the early years of the nation, the states had tremendous autonomy. In times of war, they tend to have less. In the last 60 years, they've lost some, but it goes back and forth. I think they would generally be pleased that there is still a balance, that the states still have autonomy, that it's something that we still worry about and that the Supreme Court still worries about. So I think on balance, there would be satisfaction with that.
Do you think the Constitution today is fluid enough and flexible enough to remain largely unchanged?
Well, I think it always needs to be fixed. It's, you know, we needed an amendment to get rid of slavery. We needed an amendment so women could vote and so people could elect their senators directly. It started out that state legislatures elected senators. And I think we could use a couple more. And there are a lot of people out there who think they could use other ones. But I think the Electoral College has become a barnacle. It's really a dopey way to pick a president and doesn't work very well every now and then. And I think, as I said before, the powers of the presidency need to be visited. We need to figure out how to control that.
David O. Stewart's book is called The Summer of 1787, The Men Who Invented the Constitution. David, it's been so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.